us goosebumps, Julian.
Julian.
You sound like Barry White.
My darling, I can't get enough of your little baby. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for joining us.
First, eliminate wheat. Discover what it means to live a healthy life and lose a few pounds.
Next, Internet Detectives, how amateur sleuths are solving America's coldest cases.
Then, how to get paid while you shop, travel, or dine at a fine restaurant.
Plus, an online auction site for medical services.
And it's never too late to get discovered. We'll shoot the breeze with the AARP Boomer Superstar. Three years ago, the wheat belly diet hit the shelves. It became an overnight sensation. Developed by renowned cardiologist Dr. William Davis, it calls for eliminating wheat from our diet and eating single-ingredient foods to live a more healthy and active life. According to Dr. Davis, 80 to 90% of all modern chronic conditions, including hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, joint pains, gastrointestinal struggles, depression, and others, will recede, if not outright disappear, if wheat is cut out of the diet.
Dr. Davis joins us from Milwaukee to give tips and strategies for healing the damage caused by a grain-filled diet. His latest book is Wheat Belly Total Health, The Ultimate Grain-Free Health and Weight Loss Life Plan. Well, first off, bread, which, you know, clearly contains wheat, except if it's gluten-free, it's been thought of as the staff of life for centuries. It's even in the Bible. So what's changed?
You said the magic word. What has changed? That's exactly right. So about 40 years ago, wheat in particular was changed by geneticists. And so the stuff we all remember, the 4.5 foot tall amber waves of grain, is not grown anymore. It's an 18-inch tall, short, stocky plant, a creation of a genetics laboratory, that yields more per acre, because that's what agribusiness is all about. It's trying to grow their business, trying to increase yield per acre, and have other effects like resistance to pests. But it changed the fundamental properties of this plant and its effects on humans. And when the products that came from high-yield semi-dwarf wheat, that's what this is called, everything changed for humans. It coincides perfectly with the explosion of diabetes, weight gain, obesity, autoimmune diseases. If we were told that maybe it's okay to eat it by the USDA, instead they said, make your diet dominated by wheat and grains. So now we have this incredible mess on our hands.
But doctor, how did it change? How is it genetically modified?
Well, let's be clear on this because I get criticized by the wheat industry. They say wheat is not genetically modified, and that's right. Wheat has not been genetically modified, meaning the techniques of gene splicing were not used to change wheat. What they don't tell you is that wheat was changed using other methods that don't involve gene splicing, techniques such as chemical mutagenesis, which means the purposeful induction of mutations using toxic chemicals. You can also do it with gamma rays and high-dose X-ray. You induce mutations in these plants. Now, while genetic modification introduces one, two, or three new genes, the methods of mutagenesis introduce hundreds of changes. Yet those products have been on our shelves for 30 or 40 years. So don't let that smokescreen thrown up by the grain industry that wheat is not genetically modified lull you into a false sense of safety, because it ain't safe.
Okay, so talk about why we should go grain-free. Like, why not just maybe cut it a little bit out of our diet? Why should we go cold turkey and just go grain-free?
Well, imagine you have a next-door neighbor who's an alcoholic, and he drinks 2/5 of bourbon every day, and you say, hey, John, you know what? I don't think that's good for you. Can you cut it back to 3 shots a day? Would he be better off? Well, you betcha, right? But can he do it? No, because there's an addictive process at work, and this is exactly what happens with wheat and, to various degrees, with other grains. Because they're all, I should tell your listeners, that all grains are seeds of grasses. And I mean that literally. They are seeds of grasses. And there's a protein in wheat called gliadin, a related protein in rye called sequilin, and a protein in barley called hordein, and a protein in corn called zein. These proteins are very poorly digested. They're broken down into pieces or peptides. And these peptides, because of their unique structure, bind to the opiate receptors of the human brain, and they cause addictive relationship of food with wheat. they cause you to take in more food, about 400 to 800 calories more per day, 365 days per year. And if you stop eating it, you start to go through a withdrawal process. You start to get nauseated, tired, depressed, anxious, and you get cravings. This is the opiate withdrawal process from the gliadin-derived peptides and the other related proteins and other grains. So cutting back is misery because it's going to provoke withdrawal. So just like your alcoholic friend can't cut his bourbon back from 2/5 a day to 3 shots a day, so the wheat and grain-addicted human cannot just cut back. Very few people can do that.
Well, doctor, why is it that when we gain weight, and maybe this is just in particular for women, although I see a lot of beer bellies out there, it really does seem to immediately head for our stomachs. I mean, it creates those little love handles and muffin tops, not exactly lovely for the swim season. Thank goodness we're almost beyond that. But the wheat belly diet espouses that if we eliminate all wheat, we'll not only lose weight, we'll lose it pretty quickly. Is it going to come off the middle?
It comes off body-wide. There's different sorts of weight loss. In the first week, you lose several pounds of water. Now, some people poo-poo and say, that's just a water, you're losing water. Well, that's important, too, because you retain water for a variety of reasons, including inflammation. You know, you'll see this. You'll see this in people who post their before and after pictures, even a week apart, by the way, a few days or a few weeks, on the Wheat Belly Facebook page, and you'll see this astounding change in facial contours and facial appearance, where their faces actually change. The contours are sharpened, the bags under the eyes disappear, the redness on the cheeks and nose and seborrhea recede or go away. In fact, the changes are so striking that I'm often accused of finding two people who look somewhat alike. One is slender and healthy, one is overweight and unhealthy, but these are posted by the people themselves. So the weight loss can be very profound and rapid, but first there's water loss and regression of the edema and swelling and inflammation. But then you do lose weight. Average weight loss on this about 15 to 18 pounds in the first month. Now, one thing I never say, you'll never hear me say this, cut your calories or cut your fat or push the plate away or smaller portions. I tell people, cut out the wheat and grains and eat more. Eat more fat. Use more organic butter or ghee. Use more coconut oil. Buy fatty cuts of meat. And don't trim off the fat. So have more fat. Fat is satiating and accelerates your weight loss, if that's among your goals. So don't cut your calories, don't cut your fat, don't cut your portion sizes, just eat no grains, and there's weight loss at an astoundingly rapid rate.
Our guest is Dr. William Davis, author of Wheat Belly Total Health, the ultimate grain-free health and weight loss life plan. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at twoboomerbabes.com. Now back to our conversation with cardiologist and author, Dr. William Davis.
So, doctor, you were saying about this weight loss, which my eyes are getting bigger and bigger when you mentioned 15 to 18 pounds a month. But what role does sugar play? Like you say, cut out the wheat, but, you know, increase the fats and the protein and all that. But what about sugar?
I'll tell you what most people experience. They'll often start with a statement like, well, my problem is not wheat. It's sweets. I have a sweet tooth. And I tell them, no, you don't. You have a wheat tooth. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So that gliadin protein and the related proteins in other seeds of grasses, like the cecalin and rye, they act as opiate and stimulate appetite, including for sweets, mostly for sweets. You get rid of the grains, wheat and grains. You lose that sweet tooth. It goes along with it. In fact, if you're 2 or 3 weeks into your wheat and grain-free lifestyle, and you go back, you try to have something you used to like, let's say a candy bar you used to enjoy, you spit it out. And you say, I can't eat this anymore. It's sickeningly sweet. Your desire for sweet is reduced. Your appetite is reduced. Your overall calorie intake is reduced. Your sense of taste is heightened. I believe that's because of the body-wide healing that includes the entire lining of the gastrointestinal tract from mouth to the other end. And part of that is heightened taste perception. You'll be surprised. People say things like, you know what? I now taste broccoli, and it tastes different. It's delicious. I now realize when I was eating wheat and grains, I wasn't really having the full benefit of taste. Now I taste things, and I find asparagus delicious. I find almonds sweet. The is all the heightened taste perception. So the whole notion of sweets tends to fix itself in the majority of people.
Doctor, besides bread, which is the obvious product where wheat is found, and pastas, what other products should we be aware of?
When people start looking for it, you find it in everything. You find it in licorice, taco seasoning, seasoning mixes, all frozen dinners, breakfast cereals, salad dressings, mayonnaise. You find wheat and other grains in virtually everything, about 59,000 of the 60,000 products on the store shelves. So for that reason, you want to go back to real single-ingredient foods, the foods least changed by big food, agribusiness, and other people. So you know an avocado is safe, eggs are safe, a pork chop is safe. So you go back to the simplest forms of food. Now, that's going to only take you so far, because eventually you're going to say, you know what, I've got kids to keep happy. I've got a spouse, a husband to keep happy. I've got grandkids, and I've got celebrations and holidays and weekends. What do I do then? That's why I spent a lot of time these last few years also coming up with ways to allow people to recreate familiar foods that would have required unhealthy ingredients. But you can recreate, say, a pizza or a cheesecake or a coffee cake or muffins or cookies, nearly anything that you can make with grains, you can make just as well without grains, using no wheat, no other grains, no sugars, and by the way, no gluten-free ingredients. So that's another thing to talk about. The gluten-free industry has been booming based on fiction, based on a false premise that gluten-free foods are better for you. They're not. So you can recreate those foods. And you know what's interesting about that? If I take, say, a cheesecake or a pizza, and I take out all the unhealthy ingredients, cheesecake and pizza are now health foods. You can have them for breakfast if you want.
So let's talk about the cheesecake, because that sounds really yummy. So what would you put in there? Or what would you take out?
We won't use the graham cracker crust, right?
Darn.
So let's make it instead with ground pecans or ground walnuts. Those are the best. Those are my favorites.
Ooh.
So it's real easy. I'm not a chef. I'm not a trained professional chef. I'm not a cook. I just want to make these things so people can have them. I can have them myself. And so if I can make it, your listeners can make it, because I don't use any fancy techniques. So you make the crust out of ground nuts and some butter. And the filling is cream cheese. Now, we have to put aside dairy sensitivities. There are people who have some dairy sensitivities, of course. Let's put that aside. You can, by the way, make it with coconut milk, which is kind of close to the cream cheese you use as a dairy source. But you can use a sweetener. We're going to choose our sweeteners carefully, though. We're not going to use aspartame, for instance. We're not going to use saccharin. We're not going to use agave, which is just almost pure fructose. We won't use sucrose, of course, table sugar. We'll use benign sweeteners, such as stevia or monk fruit. And by the way, your need for those sweeteners is also much reduced, because you're so sensitive to sweet now that it takes only a little bit to enjoy a little bit of sweetness in that big hunk of cheesecake you're going to have.
And what about honey as a sweetener?
Now we're getting to the issue of fructose. How safe is fructose? So all the problems of sugar come from the fructose. Honey and maple syrup, it varies, but it's around 60% fructose. So a little bit maybe won't hurt you. When you get into the tablespoon range, now you're starting to have problems from the excessive fructose exposure.
You say that wheat plays havoc on our bodies, obviously, but there may be even a correlation to seizures, if I guess you're wheat intolerant. And also, what about autoimmune skin disorders like granuloma annulare, something like that?
Big, big issues. The list of neurological diseases attributable to wheat is a long one. And this we know with confidence. This is not my speculation. This is based on extensive research, some of it at the Mayo Clinic, some of it from England. There are many large centers that have done these studies. We know that wheat causes dementia. It's called gluten encephalopathy. This diagnosis was made by the Mayo Clinic at autopsy. Last I checked, autopsy was not a good way to make a diagnosis.
No.
A British group has done extensive work in tracing two conditions back to wheat consumption. One is cerebellar ataxia, average age of onset 52. That's where you begin to stumble and lose control of your bladder and wet yourself, and you eventually become debilitated and have to use a wheelchair. That's from wheat. Peripheral neuropathies. Half of all peripheral neuropathies that are unexplained, most of them are unexplained, except for the ones that are caused by diabetes. The vast majority of peripheral neuropathies, where you lose sensation in your legs and lose control of the muscles, half of them are due to wheat. and they get better slowly, but they get better with wheat elimination. Seizures, particularly temporal lobe seizures, are diseases of wheat. And that's just the start. These diseases are growing. Multiple sclerosis can be a disease of wheat. So it's astounding how far-reaching this food can be in neurological health. Now, the irony, of course, is we're not warned about any of this, are we? We're actually told to allow it to dominate diet. When the USDA says grains, they don't really mean teff or amaranth. They mean wheat. So they tell us to allow wheat to dominate breakfast, lunch, dinner, and don't tell us that prepare yourself for the onslaught of these incredible diseases. Autoimmune diseases, very well documented. We have the work of Dr. Alessio Fasano at the University of Maryland, now at Harvard, who has published extensive work, he and his team, on showing us that the diseases of autoimmunity, whether it's a skin disease or rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or Hashimoto's thyroiditis or multiple sclerosis, are initiated by gliadin proteins in wheat and related proteins in grains. So that's the first step in creating the changes that lead to autoimmune diseases, that is, where the body's immune system attacks an organ of the body.
Well, cardiologist Dr. William Davis, author of Wheat Belly Total Health, the ultimate grain-free health and weight loss life plan, you have given us, babes, some reasons to change our diets. Thanks so much for sharing your wealth of knowledge. Up next, a glimpse into the macabre and colorful world of internet sleuths.
Believe it or not, even in an age when companies are tracking us electronically at every single moment, about 4,000 unidentified corpses turn up in the United States every year. About half of the people are murder victims. These cold cases often go uninvestigated, with unidentified human remains languishing in local police departments for decades.
Enter the web sleuth. Ordinary people who use the internet to trace the identity of nameless murder victims. Their numbers are growing. Journalist Deborah Halber explores the fascinating world of this internet subculture in her book, The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Great to have you with us, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Deborah, who are these internet detectives?
They're ordinary citizens like you and me. They're scattered across the U.S. And I think what they have in common is that they find out about these cases and they get a little bit obsessed with trying to solve them.
Well, do they actually have day jobs?
Most of them do. They might be day jobs that you consider not as intellectually challenging as you might like. So they take this on as a hobby, and they're doing this sometimes nights, sometimes weekends, and they really put a lot of time and effort into it.
So Deborah, what's their motivation, though? Why do they do it?
What I've come to feel is that even though they might happen upon these cases accidentally, it might be just somebody they know has a missing person in their lives, and they come across these websites, such as the Doe Network, as in Jane and John Doe. Initially, it's a mystery, it's a challenge to try to figure out if some missing people can be linked to unidentified human remains. But I think eventually it becomes a case of compassion where they really want to provide closure to the families.
And you said that there's this common denominator. Have a lot of these people actually lost loved ones?
I thought more of them would have or have a personal connection to missing persons. But in fact, not all of them do. And they're just some of them really just get kind of sucked into it because of the mystery involved.
So how do they use the internet to try to solve these cold cases?
Well, with the advent of the internet in the 90s, I think people realized that there was information out there about unidentified remains, and they started compiling them into databases. One of the earliest ones, and it's still around, is the Doe Network. And when it was sort of like, if you build it, they will come. So once people realized these resources were out there and available, they started looking around them and trying to make these connections.
So tell us about some of the other sites that are used by these internet detectives.
There are a variety of sites, websites. There's websleuths.com, although it has a huge number of members. Not all of them are actively trying to make these matches. On the Doe Network, most of the people on there are trying to make matches. There's Can You Identify Me? There's the Charlie Project. Most recently, there's a National Institute of Justice initiative called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, and their database is called NAMUS, NAMUS.gov.
And can anybody get on that site?
All of these sites are free and open to the public. Yes, NAMUS is completely available to anyone who wants to take a look, as is the Doe Network.
And Deborah, we understand that you actually became a cyber sleuth yourself. So tell us about the case that you worked on.
I really happened upon this world accidentally through a Massachusetts case called The Lady of the Dunes. There was a image in the Boston Globe a couple of years ago of this woman with these, you know, beautiful eyes and this kind of long auburn hair. And I realized this wasn't a photograph, but this was a reconstruction of what this murder victim had looked like. This woman had turned up dead on a beach in Provincetown, Massachusetts in 1974. And it was really mind-boggling to me that she had never been identified. So during the course of my research, I did sort of look on over a web sleuth's shoulder. There's a guy in Massachusetts named Bobby Lingos who actually has solved a bunch of these kinds of cases. And he and I were looking around for this one, but I have to admit I realized I'd make a lousy web sleuth. It's a really time-consuming and intense, and it's a hard job.
You're listening to Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes. Our guest this segment is journalist Deborah Halber, the author of Skeleton Crew, a book about the little-known world of internet sleuths. Well, Deborah, how many cases have these internet sleuths actually solved?
The numbers vary. The Doe Network, I think, is claiming around 80 cases to date. And NAMUS, because it has the ability to search, use computer programs to search for DNA matches and fingerprint matches, I think they're up in the hundreds of cases. So this is really, the recent interest in this subject has really made a huge difference, and the numbers of cases are coming along more rapidly than they were in the first 10 years.
Now, are these internet detectives working hand in hand with law enforcement, or is this completely on their own that they're solving these?
Many times they do try to work with law enforcement. There is a sort of varied response from law enforcement. They wonder sometimes why these people are calling them and emailing them about cases, and this immediately puts them on edge, essentially. Although many in law enforcement realize, you know, when these cases are 20 or 30 years old, they really do need another set of eyes, and they can use the help. So there's a sort of varied response, and some people in law enforcement, a detective in Phoenix has told me that web sleuths have helped him solve some cases of lost identity that he would not have been able to solve on his own.
And why do you think that is, that these detectives are able to solve these cases when law enforcement isn't able to?
Well, you know, sometimes it really is a matter of kind of sticking with the details and really delving into kind of the minutiae of the case. And don't get me wrong, there are plenty of detectives out there who are very committed to their cold cases and have worked on them for years. But the reality is that they have the latest thing to deal with, and they have some of these things end up on the back burner. So this is where, you know, citizen sleuths can make a really big difference. If they're going to take the time and the effort, and many are willing to do this, they can just put two and two together.
Well, tell us about the citizen sleuth Todd Matthews, who went from being a Tennessee factory worker to one of the central figures in the web sleuthing world.
Well, there was a case in Kentucky in 1968. A young woman had been found wrapped in what looked like a carnival tent by the side of a road. And she became known as Tent Girl because she had not been identified. So fast forward about 20 years, And Todd Matthews, who's a high school kid in Livingston, Tennessee, hears about the Tent Girl case from his future father-in-law. His father-in-law, Wilbur Riddle, was actually the guy who stumbled upon Tent Girl. So Todd hears about this. He becomes kind of obsessed with it. And he spends the next 10 years of his life trying to figure out the identity of Tent Girl.
And did he solve the case?
He did. Again, with the with Internet help, when that really became much more prevalent, there was a bulletin board that he was scrolling through. And a woman had posted, help me find my long-lost sister. She had been last seen in Kentucky, in Lexington, Kentucky area in the late 60s. Brown hair, brown eyes, petite, and Todd just knew that had to be her.
Wow. And Todd has since become a very central figure, right, in this whole detective world?
Yeah, Todd, after that, became involved with the early days of the Doe Network. He was not one of the people who created it, but he was involved very early on, and he is still involved with that website. And he's now actually the a national spokesperson for NAMIS, for the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System.
Deborah Halber, author of The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. This conversation has been fascinating and, I must say, a bit bone-chilling. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, a way to combine shopping with detective work and make some money. Stay with us. If you love you some retail therapy and secretly desire to be a spy, you can merge the two and make money from shopping instead of spending it. How? Mystery shopping. A company hires you to grade everything from the cleanliness of a hotel's carpet in the lobby to the power of the hairdryer in the bathroom.
One mystery shopping company is Sensors Quality Management. Its president, David Lipton, joins us on the phone from Toronto to tell us how it all works. So what exactly is a mystery shopper?
A mystery shopper is pretty much what you just suggested. They're anonymous customers, guests, passengers aboard planes, buses, trains, etc. And basically you are evaluating the levels of quality, service, and cleanliness for various companies. We're not consultants. We don't go telling a company how to run their business. We just let them know if it's running the way that they'd like.
So are these individuals? Are they families or couples?
It all depends. Usually we're hiring people to do the mystery shops. They're individuals, but in many instances, they're allowed to take either one person or an entire family along on the mystery shops, depending on what the assignments are.
Now, do these individuals have to have knowledge of a particular industry? Say, if you go mystery shop in a hotel, do you have to know about hotels?
It all depends on what the client wants. In some cases, the client just wants your Joe or Joanne average customer that knows very little, if anything, about that business or that industry. And in other cases, they want a much more critical eye for detail, and they do want somebody who has some experience or a background in that particular business or industry.
So what qualities do you really look for a successful mystery shopper? Because Barbara and I are wanting to put in our application.
The most important quality is that you're reliable and responsible.
Check.
It's important to have a keen eye for detail, somebody who will write down a lot of notes and provide a lot of insight and feedback, and somebody who's available and interested in going to different types of businesses in different types of industries, be it retail, restaurants, hotels. Having said that, sometimes it's maybe a little less glamorous and you're just taking a car for a test drive, and unless you really love automobiles, and that might not be as exciting, or going to the bank and talking to them about investments. But all industries and many companies use our services, and the more that you're interested in evaluating, the more valuable that you're going to be to a company like us.
Well, are mystery shoppers paid?
It all depends on the individual project. It sort of runs the spectrum. In some cases, when you're, say, evaluating a bank or car dealership, you are typically paid for your time and effort. In other cases, you might be sort of middle of the road where, say, at a restaurant, you get to dine either yourself or possibly bring some other people along, but you might get a little bit of compensation in form of money, say, for gas and, again, for your time. In other cases, you might be going to a fancy restaurant or a resort and not being paid at all. And then in some cases, we have a group of assignments where you're actually paying to go do the work, but you get a significant discount off of the cost of, say, airfare, train fare, or maybe a week at a resort.
Well, my ears really perked up on that five-star resort that you were talking about.
There are a few of them in the system.
Wow.
Whoa.
So say you send somebody to this five-star resort, what would they be expected to do?
Anything from making their reservation through to arriving, evaluating the check-in process, going over their room with a fine-tooth comb, making sure that there's no mold in the washroom or hair on the bed. Of course, it gets much more detailed from there. They might be going to the restaurants and the lounges and evaluating the food and beverage service in the resort. They might be actually evaluating the pool or the beach and various services that go along with those areas.
And what about the spas? Do they get to evaluate the massages and the facials?
In many cases, they actually do get to evaluate the spas as well.
Ooh, that would be our cup of tea for sure. So is it really competitive to be selected as a shopper?
We have over 100,000 members of our field force. I wish I had over 100,000 assignments on a monthly basis, but we're not there yet. So there is some competition. It's usually the more experienced shoppers, and when I say experienced shoppers, the ones who are willing to take those lesser appealing assignments and sort of move up the ladder in terms of internally here to do the more complicated mystery shops or the more exciting mystery shops. Sometimes it's a trade-off where if you'll do something for us that we need done in a challenging area, you also get your pick of the crop in terms of the more exciting projects as well. So, yeah, there is some competition, and the ones that also, they're graded on the final version that they submit of the inspections, we take a look at that, and the ones who their spelling and grammar is better, they provide more detailed notes, they provide more insight, those are, of course, the people who we want doing the inspections.
David, can you give us an idea of how much mystery shoppers are paid, if they are paid a rate?
It goes anywhere from not being paid at all, or in some cases actually paying a small percentage of your airfare, train fare, cruise, or your time in the hotel or resort. In some cases, you are being paid for certain work. It might be $20, $50, maybe $75 an assignment for the more challenging and time-consuming assignments. Most retail and restaurant mystery shops, you're paid anywhere from probably $10 to $20 on average, plus you're getting a purchase along with that, or you're getting a meal.
You know, I'm wondering if any of these mystery shoppers are ever outed. I mean, I would imagine if you're in the lobby and checking out the pillows, they might get a little suspicious. Does that ever happen?
Every once in a while, I suppose it does happen. We're dealing with thousands and hundreds of thousands of individuals. I think most mystery shoppers know what they have to do. They're prepared in advance. They're a little bit more discreet when it comes to taking notes down. They're either scribbling something in a daytimer or even on the back of a magazine. These days, everybody is always typing on their smartphone, so you don't look out of place. Every once in a while, you could even head off to the washroom to scribble some notes where nobody's going to see you. So in most cases, they aren't caught. They're not identified. I always have some fun when a client will call and say, well, we figured out who your mystery shopper was, and they're suggesting that it's a 5-foot, bald, heavyset gentleman. And then I take a look, and it was a 6-foot-tall blonde with long hair. So every once in a while, everybody thinks that they know the mystery shoppers, and I guess that's actually part of the fun and part of the challenge and part of the way that we improve service. If anybody is interested in applying as a mystery shopper, they can do so on our website. It's www.sqm.ca. And again, that's www.sqm.ca.
David Lipton, president of Sensors Quality Management, a mystery shopping company. This has really been fun. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me.
There's a slew of online companies that connect people to services, like travel, home repairs, even dating. Now there's a company that links patients seeking non-emergency medical care with doctors and facilities through an online auction. It's called MetaBid. The founder, Ralph Weber, joins us on the phone from Houston to tell us how it works. Welcome, Ralph.
Happy to be with you today.
Well, tell us how MetaBid works. I mean, I'm kind of visualizing like a price line for medical care. Is that right?
That's actually a pretty good way to describe it. We've been described as the Travelocity of healthcare, the Match.com of healthcare. We work two ways, both with self-funded employers and with just individuals who are just shopping for a cash price. Whether that is an employee or just an individual, it works more or less the same way. The person goes online and they make a medical request. For example, I need a hip replacement. They can put in some parameters such as how far they're willing to travel. They could even say, you know, my budget is X dollars if they want to. They answer a few brief health questions and then they can upload some x-rays, some images, some diagnoses, and then they submit the request. The request is sent out to every physician registered with MetaBid that performs that procedure, and those physicians are invited to submit a bid, a global bid, on that episode of care.
Now, is there a fee for using MetaBid?
Yes, there is. When an employer uses MetaBid, it's usually they pay, you know, a certain, you know, a few dollars per month for each employee, depending on how many employees they have. They will pay that so that the employee just goes on and then they don't have to pay at the time of use. If it's an individual, our current prices are $25 for a single request, and or they can join for $4.95 a month for a single person with no dependents.
So what types of procedures do people actually bid on?
All kinds. Everything from colonoscopies, MRIs, knee replacements, triple bypass surgery, cosmetic, eye surgery, all kinds.
And so how many consumers or seekers have used this service so far?
I don't know the exact number because we're just finishing our month end, but a few thousand anyway.
Well, tell us about the consumers here. I mean, are they people without health care insurance, or maybe they just have really high deductibles? Like, why would somebody use your services?
Well, there's a few different kinds of consumers that we have. Some are just, like you said, people without insurance or really high deductibles that just want to save money. They want to see what the price is in advance. More of them want to see what the actual profile of the doctor is. You know, where did he or she get his, you know, their training? What are their outcomes? What are their quality results? How many procedures do they do per year? That is usually more important than the actual price. Not that the price isn't important. The employees that have a plan through their employer that allows them to shop for care often will get a deductible waived if they get it at a more cost-effective price. So those are the other ones. The third category are some of the faith-based healthcare sharing ministries that are exempt from the ACA, and they just share the cost among fellow members. So they come because they're paying cash, so they want to make sure that they're getting a good value proposition as well.
And do you get many seekers from abroad?
Yeah, actually we do. We get a lot of people from Canada that are, you know, maybe on waiting lists. We also get some from, you know, overseas that want to come to the U.S. for care, and some Americans that want to go overseas for care. So we have providers in 10 different countries. We do outbound and inbound medical tourism.
And how many doctors are registered right now as bidders?
We have a little bit over 6,000 total.
Wow. And what about hospitals and outpatient surgery centers?
Probably, well, we just have a number. I mean, they sign up all the time. We have, you know, definitely over a few hundred.
Hmm. This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with Ralph Weber, founder of MetaBid, an online auction site for medical procedures. Where are these procedures usually performed? I mean, are you guaranteed a hospital, or would they be at a surgery center, or how would you figure out
where to do this?
Well, when a procedure can be done in a doctor's office or a surgery center, it's obviously going to be more cost-effective. You know, for example, a colonoscopy done in a doctor's office is going to be a lot less than a colonoscopy done in a hospital. In some states, the medical board does not allow that to happen. So in some cases, going from one state to another to get a procedure done means you can have it done in an ambulatory surgery center or in a doctor's office, whereas in their home state they couldn't. So crossing the state lines will help that. More and more procedures all the time are doable in ambulatory surgery centers.
Right, except they've been given a little bit of a bad rap lately with, you know, Joan Rivers. And I would think a lot of people might feel a little bit more confident if they were, you know, in a hospital for some of these procedures.
Well, ambulatory surgery centers have to pass very stringent quality standards. They have to, you know, make sure that everything is in place for all kinds of different unforeseen circumstances. They have a very high level that they have to meet. So, and that doesn't mean that you know, bad things can't happen. They can happen in surgery centers. They can happen at hospitals. When somebody that's as famous as Joan Rivers, when it happens to that person, of course, everybody knows about it.
Well, are the doctors who participate vetted or screened in any way?
Absolutely. When a new doctor wants to sign up with MediBid, we will run their medical license to make sure that they're licensed and in good standing. Now, you know, at the time that a patient accepts a bid, we will email the doctor's license number to that person, and we say, listen, at the time they signed up, they were licensed in good standing, but here's their license number. We recommend that you vet the person yourself just to make sure you're satisfied, and if you're not, just let us know, and we'll happily, you know, give you another option.
And do you find that perhaps newer doctors or just, you know, recently crowned doctors sign up more to be participants than those that are very seasoned and have a big wait list?
Actually, not really. Not really. You know, I wouldn't say it's one way or the other. We get a cross-section of both. Doctors who are very experienced, have been doing this for a long time, in some cases, in many cases, they just don't like dealing with Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies where they have to bill and then their bill is discounted and then, you know, it's sometimes a pain for them to collect. So they like to just say, here's my price and this is the price that I set and here's why I set it and get paid at the time of care. So often we'll have experienced doctors that are even more enthusiastic than newer ones.
Say a patient accepts a bid from an out-of-town doctor. So what happens with the follow-up care? You know, what happens after the surgery?
Usually, so let's say that I'm traveling from Houston to Phoenix for a knee replacement, for example. The doctor would say in advance, okay, you know, my bid will include one pre-op and two post-op visits. If you'd like to stay in a, you know, 1 or 2 week extended care facility, like a extended stay hotel, then we will provide some PT. However, you're going to have to do the rest when you get home, and we'll give you a prescription for this and coordinate with your local service provider.
This is Barb and Kathy, the two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with Ralph Weber, founder of MediBid, an online auction site for medical procedures.
Well, what happens if there are complications from the procedure? Is the doctor responsible for any follow-up care?
Well, it depends on what kind of complication that is. There are complications which may be physician error. And, of course, in that case, there's no question that the physician would be responsible. Sometimes that there are complications which are not due to physician error. And in those cases, usually the providing physician is very compassionate and usually offers to help to do the follow-up care. Sometimes it's not practical because of the distance. That's usually something that's discussed between the physician and patient before they perform the procedure.
And then, Ralph, do you see this type of service as kind of the wave of the future for non-emergency medical care?
Absolutely. We have become so opaque about transparency, quality, and pricing in our current healthcare system. Some of the hospitals in Houston are running with 20% of their beds filled and 80% empty. So they have, you know, really high fixed costs, and they have to cost shift and overcharge some people to make up for their inefficiencies in you know, their own services. So I think patients are looking for an alternative. They, you know, especially the younger generation, the millennials, they want to be able to research. They want to be able to see, okay, this doctor that you know, just because he or she is in-network, that doesn't tell me anything. I want to learn a little bit more, where to go to medical school, et cetera. So they want the transparency and quality. They want to know what the outcomes of the doctor are, and they want to know the price.
What's the difference between, I mean, all that information is really available online these days for patients about their doctors?
Yeah, a lot of information is available online. When they go to a traditional insurance doctor, some carriers are a little bit more transparent than others, but usually they're just shuffled off to, you know, a preferred provider, and they have sometimes limited choices as to who they can go to. With healthcare costs increasing, a lot of the big insurance companies are responding with narrow networks, which means less choice. A lot of the employers are saying, you know, narrow networks, less choice, you know, is not as good for my employees. And with more higher and higher deductibles, they just don't like that. So they are embracing something like Medibid, where there's transparency in quality and price.
Well, finally, is there one procedure that really stands out as being, say, the most popular bid item?
I'm going to give you a wide category. Orthopedic procedures are probably number one. You know, within orthopedic, knees and hips are some of the more popular. We also do get a lot of colonoscopies. We had one patient travel from Chicago to Oregon for a colonoscopy.
Wow.
Sounds like you have a lot of boomer patients.
Yes, we do. This particular colonoscopy, the gentleman in Chicago, the best price he could find in Chicago, and he called around. He spent a lot of time on the phone. The best price he can get was $3,500. He came to Medibid. He got a bid from Oregon for $800. Even after he pays for his flight, his hotel, and his car rental, he still saved $2,000.
And he had a vacation.
Exactly. Yes.
Ralph Weber, founder of Medibid, an online medical auction site, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks a lot for having me, Garvin, Kathy.
Have you ever dreamed of being a superstar, singing your way to fame and fortune? Well, don't let the dream die. Julian Hernandez and Kay Wright tied for first place in the AARP-sponsored Boomer Superstar Contest. They outscored 1,000 other entrants. Julian Hernandez joins us to shoot the breeze about the contest and his soaring musical career. Welcome, Julian.
Hello.
First of all, Kathy and I extend our sincerest and proudest congratulations to you.
Thank you very much. I'm so overwhelmed with this. My heart is pounding.
Oh, how wonderful. So, Julian, tell us, what inspired you to enter the contest?
I work with a young lady. Her name is Dominique Carmen, and we have a duo act that we've been doing for years. And somebody gave her the ad, and they said, you guys should enter this and as a duo, you know. So she said to me, listen, gave me the paper. She said, you guys should check it out and see what this is about. So I kind of procrastinated. She kept hounding me, and I checked it out, and I said, oh, we can't do a duo. And she couldn't do a single because she's Canadian, so she's not a citizen. So then she hounded me some more. Do the video, send it in. I don't know, boomer, superstar, I don't know. So she really was responsible for me, like, taking it to the video level. And then next thing I know, I'm top 30. You know, I'm top 8, top 5, top 2, and boom.
Well, have you always been a singer? I mean, other than in the shower?
No, I've always been a singer. Yeah, I've been singing since I was 14. I've been on the road. I've done all kinds of things, you know. So, yeah, I've always sung. Thank God. Thank you, Lord.
Wow. Well, now, there were more than 1,000 entries. What song did you submit that just wooed the judges and won them over?
That was the song by the Four Tops, I Believe in You and Me, and it also was re-recorded again with Whitney Houston.
I believe in dreams again. I believe that love will never end. And like the river finds the sea.
Ooh, you gave us goosebumps, Julian.
Julian.
You sound like Barry White.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Well, I do a lot of voices. That's how I started singing. I started to sing thinking that I had to imitate people. So I started doing all kinds of arrays of voices. So like Louis Armstrong, Elvis, I do all kinds of stuff. I have a lot of fun with it.
So, Julian, who were the judges?
Oh, my God, the judges are phenomenal. We had Emilio Estefan, which is, Gloria Estefan's husband, and 18 Grammys. I was blown away with him. He was incredible. We had Patty Austin, who I wanted to run on stage and sing Baby Come to Me with her. I'm like, oh, God, I thought I probably got pulled off the stage. And Taylor Hicks, who was so nice to all of us.
Oh, I love him.
Oh, Taylor Hicks is and very talented. My God, he's really live. I was, like, really super impressed. I mean, I saw him on the American Idol, but and he was hugging us and kissing us and telling us, hey, you know, man, you know, go for the dream. Look, I'm here. He's doing his Vegas thing. It was great. And then we had the great Randy Jackson.
Ooh, that Randy.
You know, dog, you know, he was dogging me all the way. Hey, dog, you know. And he gave me, after I did my first song, he titled me the Smooth Teddy Bear.
Ooh, that's high praise from him.
Which I really like. I think I'm going to keep that, man. You know, from now on, ladies, I'm going to be dressed as the Smooth Teddy Bear.
Well, Julian, rumor has it that you actually brought the audience to their feet with your song.
Yes, actually, I had two standing ovations. I was blown away. You can imagine, I was like, I'm pins and needles, and I come out there, and I'm like biting my nails right before I go on, and then I started singing, and the ladies just kind of dug the song, and they started going, ooh, and I said, oh, that got me all encouraged. I said, okay, girls, here we go. Because I have a lot of ladies that come to see me, you know.
Well, we bet you do, Julian.
Because, you know, the people love the Luther Vandross, you know, and I think that's one thing that I want to, you know, send out when I do my spot for the 19 records. I want to tell them, listen, we got to bring romance back, you know. We got to bring, you know, we got to bring the love thing back, you know.
Well, Julian, so where do you go from here? Where does the superstar head?
Well, the superstar is heading to have a major audition with 19 Entertainment, which is the, actually 19 Records and 19 Entertainment. They are the record company for American Idol.
Wow.
That is fabulous.
I want to represent our boomers. You know what I'm saying?
Well, Julian Hernandez, co-winner of AARP's Boomer Superstar Contest, you totally rock. You are an inspiration to us boomers.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.